Okay, I'm here with Zupinda Keith, and this is Yanni Chapman, and we're going to talk about the history of slavery in Chapel Hill and how that legacy of both institutional racism and resistance has come down to us over time through history, and so how it manifests itself today and how we might celebrate that history of freedom struggle and also expose that history of institutional racism and challenge it. So I thought maybe we'd talk about this. I'm sort of the historian on this, but the point is to develop a way of talking about this that connects with where people are. So what kind of questions come to your mind, Zupinda? None?
Well, no. I think that it is just getting a little more history of Chapel Hill. And I think the thing that concerns me the most is why the education is in the state that it's in, and why it seems that, you know, being an outsider coming in, that the African-American community, especially the younger community, and the children in school are very disengaged in the community. And so there's this history of why it is the way that it is now. And I think that, you know, to understand how we can move forward and help make that change, we've got to understand, I need to understand what's happened in this community over many years, but in particularly, you know, the last 30 or 40 years, and why hasn't it been able to move forward, and why don't we have these changes in place?
Well, one of the I think that that's a good place to start, because that's where we're starting from. The end is the beginning. I mean, and the whole point of studying this stuff is to shoot the arrow at the target, with the arrow being the historical understanding and the target being changing things. And so if we're talking about slavery and how that impacts the last 30, 40 years and the current situation, I think it's really important to appreciate both the devastating impact of slavery that still manifests itself today, and the tremendous ways, the tremendous perseverance and strength and creativity that people showed in surviving slavery and fighting it, and then carrying those kinds of struggles on after emancipation, and up through Jim Crow and up into the present. So I think an awful lot of white people in particular, and maybe a lot of black people too, and other people, don't really appreciate the way slavery, the history of slavery, makes things different for African Americans than it is for anybody else. You know, some people say, well, okay, you know, my parents were immigrants. My family were immigrants. They had to struggle. They were exploited. They were oppressed. And I don't see what's so different about that from black people, you know, and our group that was religiously oppressed in Egypt, let's say, Coptic Christians, I know somebody who said this to me, said, we've managed to come here and build a community and not, you know, wallow in self-despair or something like that. And I don't see why. I think talking about slavery is a cop-out for black people. Mm-hmm. So I think that it's important to come to grips with the reality of slavery and how that affected people and how people survived it. So just a few basics about slavery in North Carolina and Chapel Hill. The first slaves in North Carolina came with Spanish explorers in the 1500s. And we don't know what happened to them because those Spanish explorers didn't leave. Mm-hmm. So there was quite a few slaves from Africa who ended up being in North Carolina, and nobody knows their history.
So this was before the 1600s.
Yes.
When it was sort of began being documented then. So it was already a 100-year history of slaves in this area.
Right. And so then the first slaves that weren't Spanish slaves, and there wasn't a whole lot of those Spanish slaves except in Florida, which was a Spanish territory up into the 19th century. And the first European settlers in North Carolina came in from Virginia, mm-hmm. into the northeast part of North Carolina called the Albemarle region. And they brought slaves with them. They weren't all slave owners who came at all. In fact, a bunch of them were, you know, poor white people trying to get away from Virginia. And North Carolina was sort of a safe haven.
This was in what time?
This was in the early 1600s. What, am I right about that? No, it was in the early 1700s. 1600s. 1620 or so was when the first slaves landed in.
And that was documented.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Jamestown. Quiet, doggies. So the first slaves in North Carolina were much later than slavery developed in, say, Virginia.
Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. So we started having some slaves in the early 1700s, and then at some point in there, around this, you know, and still in the early 1700s, a whole group of slave owners from the Barbados decided to migrate to North Carolina and set up colonies. So they came in through Charleston, South Carolina. The whole thing was one Carolina at that point. Mm-hmm. But they came in through Charleston, South Carolina, and which was the main slave entry port in along the Atlantic. And they moved up into North Carolina, into places along the eastern coast. That's the east coast of North Carolina is called it's the lowlands. It's, you know, the flat, near sea level,
mm-hmm.
lands that were really good for plantation agriculture. And then as you move, you know, 100 or more miles inland, you get foothills of the mountains, and it's called the Piedmont, which is where we are.
Right.
And then you go further west, you get the mountains. So all the first settlement in North Carolina that was European was along the coast. And the slave owners built up big plantations along the coast. And by far, that's where slavery was concentrated. And there were many other white farmers who came into North Carolina who were not slave owners.
Where were they from?
Well, I can tell you in Orange County, which got settled in the 1750s, 1740s, 1750s, which was considered the West in terms of North Carolina at that point. It became a county in 1752. And they came from Pennsylvania mostly. And they came down this thing called the Great Wagon Trail. and a lot of them were looking for cheaper land because Pennsylvania was built up, mm-hmm. Getting built up. And there were also a lot of Indian wars in Pennsylvania, so they migrated down, this great wagon route, and then they ended up in central North Carolina.
And they were not slave owners.
By and large, they were not slave owners. They were small independent farmers. A lot of them were Germans, but there was all kinds of other folks mixed in there. It wasn't a totally homogeneous population. So you ended up with a situation, say, around the time of the founding of the university, which was in 1793, where you had the state fairly well settled up to about the mountains. Mm-hmm. Well, there was beginning to be settlement in the mountains. And the slave owners were concentrated in the eastern part of the state. And a county like Orange, so some of those eastern counties would have slave populations that were 50% or more of the population. Mm-hmm. In Orange County, the black population around 1800 or so was about 30% of the population, maybe a little bit more. And only about, I think it was about 30% of the white population were slave owners. So the majority of white people were not slave owners. And the majority of the slave owners were not wealthy slave owners. They owned one or two or less than five slaves. If you owned more than, I'm forgetting something here. I think it was more than 20 or more than 10 slaves. Then you were considered a wealthy slave owner, and you were part of what was designated loosely as the gentry. And the gentry existed in all parts of the state. There were big slave owners in the mountainous regions too. And in fact, the biggest slave owner in the state was in Orange County. And that was Paul Cameron. Cameron Avenue out here in Chapel Hill is named after Paul Cameron. Cameron Indoor Stadium at Duke, named after the Cameron family. The Camerons are a big, historically important family that became important because they were slave owners. And so, but in Orange County, the number of people who were he had about 1,000 slaves on, maybe 3 or 4 different plantations.
Right here in Orange County.
Well, not all of his slaves were in Orange County. Some of them were in other places. But right here in Orange County, he had something like 300 slaves.
And this was after 1750?
Yeah.
Right around in there?
Well after 1750. This Paul Cameron actually inherited his slaves from his father, Benahan Cameron. And he was, when I say he was the biggest slave owner, that was in 1860. So before the Civil War, Paul Cameron was the biggest slave owner in North Carolina. And so you had this small percentage of slave owners, maybe 10% of the slave owners, who were part of the gentry, and yet politically they were the most powerful people in the state, and they pretty much controlled the legislature, although not completely, because obviously there was a lot of non-slave owning white people in North Carolina, but they completely controlled the university, and they were basically the power in most counties and in state government, mm-hmm. and so on and so forth. And when the university was well, before I go further, do you got any questions about some of that history?
No, just
anything jump out at you?
Well, no, just the landowners came. It, And this Orange County was settled in the 40s and 50s, 1700, 40s and 50s, right? And then UNC was founded in 1793.
Well, they actually started building the buildings at UNC in 1793.
And those buildings were built by?
Slaves. White slave-owning contractors.
Okay.
Contracted with the university to build the buildings. James Patterson and some other people.
But that wasn't a large percent of the population, right? Because there were not that many slaves here.
Chapel Hill was not a community before the university was here. It was a tiny crossroads place. There might have been an inn, there might have been a blacksmith shop, there might have been some kind of a grist mill. Mm-hmm. And there was a chapel, an Anglican chapel. Anglican was, you know, before the Revolution, the Anglican Church of England was the official state religion of mm-hmm. North Carolina. So those things were here, but until the university was founded in 1793, there was no town of Chapel Hill.
Okay.
Now the people who gave land to the university as a way of enticing the university to come to this area, I mean, there was a competition around the state, in certain parts of the mm-hmm. state, for people to come forward with gifts of money and land for the university. And it was thought that if the university was built in your community, it was going to eventually be a big deal. Your property that you owned would go mm-hmm. up in value, right. Be good for business, all that kind of thing. And so the property owners who contributed something more than 1,000 acres to the university were either all or mostly slave owners, even though Orange County was maybe only 30% slave owners, and of those, only maybe 10% of the slave owners were gentry.
So is it that 10% that were gentry that gave the majority of the land?
Well.
And got the contracts to build the university with their slaves?
Even at that time in 1793, there really weren't that many people who had more than 20 slaves. Mm-hmm. So a lot of the people who gave land to the university had 6 slaves or 10 slaves or whatever. James Patterson had 19 slaves because he was a builder and, you know, his slaves, he used them for building.
Is that Patterson Hall?
No. I don't think Patterson has anything named after him.
Okay. So I think I'm trying to wrap my brain around
the gentry?
No, the labor force that it took to build the university. Where did all the blacks, where did all the African Americans come from?
Okay.
If there was just a small, because I'm thinking there's a small number here, right? As in 1793, there was a small amount. So where did they come from? Where did they?
So. You have to remember that the university was nothing like it is today. We've got something like 25,000 students today, 5,000 employees, blah, blah, blah. The first year that the university was open in 1795, it only had about 40 or 50 students, a couple of professors, and probably 2 slaves who were rented to the university, November Caldwell and I can't think of the other guy's name right now. They were the first couple of slaves. And
you say rented.
Yeah, the university didn't own them exactly, although they seemed to be passed on within the university. They always worked, their families always worked for the university. Caldwell's were always slaves at the university. They were called university servants. And Caldwell was named Caldwell because his owner was the first president of the university who married one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, I believe, or someone related to him, who had given his daughter a slave, and that was November Caldwell. And so, you know, November. And so that person, November Caldwell, became one of the first university servants. And it's never been, I've never been able to find records of actual rental transactions. Mm-hmm. So it's not totally clear to me. These slaves did belong to the president of the university.
What was his name?
Joseph Caldwell.
So Joseph Caldwell owned November Caldwell and rented him
to the university. Although I've never been able to find
the transactions.
Transactions there. So when people say the university didn't own slaves, to me that may have been true in the case of November Caldwell, but it's a little bit of a gray area because November Caldwell was a slave for life at the university as a university servant. His son, Wilson Swain Caldwell,
was also a slave.
Was also a slave until emancipation.
How old was November Caldwell around 1795?
I'm not totally sure, but he may not have even been all that young then. But I've got background information on him, but I just can't recall right now how old he was.
So his son was also owned by Joseph Caldwell's?
No, his son was owned by the next president of the university, whose name was David Lowry Swain. Hmm. So probably what happened was November Caldwell got married to or had a child with one of President Swain's slaves, and then that child became Wilson Swain. And then later on, he took the name Caldwell because mm-hmm. November Caldwell was his father, and he was claiming his father by doing that. Because one of the indignities and repressions against slaves was to not really allow them their own last names.
Right.
So in the early days, the workforce that maintained the university was very small, just a couple of slaves. I mean, it's like three or four professors and a couple of slaves.
Okay.
Now, there was also a larger workforce of slaves who helped maintain the university in Chapel Hill, who worked for innkeepers. They were cooks. They were washerwomen. They did quite a few different things. But basically, the university always contracted out a great deal of its labor, either directly or indirectly, with local merchants, local slave owners. So there was actually more slaves involved in the maintenance of the students and the faculty mm-hmm. than there might have appeared to be if you just look at the two university servants. And now to build the university was very small in the beginning, and there was one building that was Old East. That was built, started in 1793 and built, and it opened as the university in 1795. And it wasn't even as big as it is now. It was added on to later. And the workforce on that, we don't have a whole lot of real specific information about how big it was, but I do know that in 1800, this guy Patterson, who was the contractor, had 19 slaves. Now, he probably may have rented additional slaves to work on the building, or perhaps his slaves were enough. He probably also paid free black skilled laborers and probably free white skilled laborers also to work on the building. But there was actually, during slavery, there was a fair number of skilled black workers.
That were free.
Some of them were free, some of them were slaves. Just because you were a slave didn't mean you worked in the cotton fields. You know, there were slaves who were skilled carpenters or plasterers or brick masons or things like that. Some of those job categories have actually were held onto by black people over the years, mm-hmm. so that the stonemasons in Chapel Hill and the bricklayers were black, mm-hmm. primarily. But slavery, there was actually a fairly good percentage of the slaves who were skilled. And they were they were more highly valued.
And they were free?
Well, they were slaves, but there were some skilled black workers who were free.
Well, where did they come from? Because I'm thinking we're in the South.
So what does that mean to you, that we're in the South?
Well, I guess I didn't realize that there were free blacks in the South. But
yes.
And a small number of them? And were they freed in the South, or did they come from up North?
Primarily they were freed in the South. In 1800, there were no free black people, or as they call them, free people of color, in Chapel Hill.
Okay.
There were some in some other counties and some other towns, but the number was very small in North Carolina.
Okay.
This changed over the years, and as more and more slaves managed to become emancipated or bought their freedom. And up until 1831 or so, the laws were slightly liberal in terms of emancipation. If you wanted to emancipate your slaves, you could. Mm-hmm. And of course, the Quakers, who were a big group in Guilford County, they emancipated their slaves a lot of times. And other people did too sometimes. I mean, sometimes, for instance, a slave owner would have a child by a slave, and they might emancipate that slave at a certain point, you know, because they often gave preference to their children. But little by little, the number of free persons of color increased in North Carolina, so that there was, I think, something like 30,000 free persons of color in 1860. I might have that number wrong, but I think that's what it was. And in Chapel Hill, there was actually about half the population was black in Chapel Hill in 1860. And when we're only talking about 1,000, 1,200 people, you know, total population.
Yes, uh-huh.
And we're not counting the students, of whom there was about 500 and some.
Mm-hmm.
But the permanent population was basically half black and half white. And of the black part of the population, about 20% were free. And that actually was only about maybe a dozen or 15 families.
Mm-hmm.
But I have done a lot of research on those free families, and you can find them in your manuscript census, and you can tell that they're free because, you know, they'll be listed in the free census, and they'll have you know, when it comes to their color, they'll be either black or mulatto. And it's very interesting. Someone needs to do more research on these free people of color in Chapel Hill, because they no doubt had a significant impact of some kind. Some of them were skilled. Some of them were servants.
So the majority of the university started in 1793. It opened in 1795 with one building. Sorry, Yoni.
No problem. Do whatever you need to do.
Oh my goodness. Explain to me from 1800. From 1800 to 1860, how much of the university was built?
By slaves? Mm-hmm. I would say all of it. There was undoubtedly free workers who also worked on the slave, but the bulk of the workforce was slaves. So, for instance, in the first buildings, which were Old East, South Building, mm-hmm. Person Hall, some of these. The bricks were made on the spot, or else they were contracted with brick makers in Hillsborough or someplace nearby. And the way those bricks were made was slaves dug the clay out of the ground. So they had a big clay pit right over here at the university near near South Building. The clay was dug out of the ground. It was treated in ways that you needed to make good bricks. I mean, maybe they added straw, or maybe they took out rocks, or I'm not quite sure exactly what they did. And it was packed into molds. And this was all done by slaves. And then you had to have these firing kilns, which were these great big long brick ovens. Mm-hmm. And the fires had to be kept tended 24 hours a day during the time that you were baking the bricks. So the slaves did all that. And then the slaves transported the bricks to the building site, and they were the ones who laid the stone and laid the bricks. And they also cut down trees and sawed them in a saw pit, and or shaped them with an axe for the oak planks and beams of the buildings. Slaves gathered and hauled clamshells from the coast and brought them by wagon to Chapel Hill. I think they were brought as clamshells to Chapel Hill. And then they were fired and turned into lime. And this was all done by slaves. And the lime was mixed with sand, which was dug up out of the local streams and so forth by slaves. And actually in later years, when they dug up some sand for building at the university, they discovered Indian settlements and lots of arrowheads and stuff like that. So we know that Indians lived here before, right here at the university, before all this. And so the slaves, you know, they were carpenters, they were brick masons, they worked with cement, they basically did all the work.
So how many during the major construction period of the university? Was the major construction period between 1795 and 1860?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by the major construction period. That was the antebellum construction period. And there weren't really a whole ton of buildings that were built. Mm-hmm. There was maybe Smith Hall was one of the last. was built in 1850. Mm-hmm. There was New East and New West person. One begins with a G. Anyways, there was probably less than a dozen buildings.
That were built during that period.
They were mostly built by slaves. The university library, after a lot of the organizing that we did around the stuff, history of slavery and Cornelia Phillips and all, the librarians actually did a big research project on slavery in the university. And it's online, and it lists all the stuff that they could find in the archives about letters from trustees or people at the university about what slaves were doing, even a few letters from slaves, some of the records about building university buildings, things like that. So...
And that was all contract labor? And you haven't...
That was all contract labor, yeah.
And you haven't been able to find the transactions for any of those, or...
Well, actually, I mean, in other words, like say with Patterson, who built Old East, I have found, and it's fairly easy to find, all of his lists of materials and his letters to the trustees and progress reports and all that kind of thing. There were lots of disputes between these contractors and the trustees, even like William Davy. You know, there was dissatisfaction on both sides. And the thing that you don't find in those reports is very much that indicates what kind of outlays they were for the workers, for the slaves. You know, how much were they fed? Where did they live?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I don't know as much about that. I haven't been able to find out as much about that. I think it's probably knowable, but it would take more digging and original research than I've done.
So how involved was Paul Cameron's slaves? You say they donated. He donated a lot of the land?
No. Paul Cameron and his father, Benahan, who would have been around in the early part of the 19th century. They didn't donate any land for the original university.
Mm-hmm.
They did donate a lot of funds over the years to the university, and both Paul Cameron and his father were prominent members of the Board of Trustees.
His
slaves were not involved in building the university, as far as I know. They were plantation slaves.
Okay. So while he had the most, they did not have any hands in the university?
Not that I know of. I mean, we do know which people contracted for which buildings and who the architects were and things like that. But Paul Cameron wasn't part of that, as far as I know. Now, also, just to fill out the story of the role of slaves in the antebellum university, you need to know that, first of all, the trustees were mostly members of the gentry.
Mm-hmm.
Originally, the university was conceived of as part of the revolution, as sort of something that would ensure liberty and not aristocracy.
Mm-hmm.
So it would give people a chance to acquire education. So it was sort of a progressive thing, and there were a lot of non-slave owning people in the state who wanted a public university.
Mm-hmm.
That was part of why it was public. Because
mm-hmm.
before that, all education had been privately private, and only rich people could take advantage of it. So the idea was to have a public university. That was part of the revolutionary thrust. And what happened was, as the slave owners became more dominant after the revolution in the whole politics and economic power of the state, they were already dominant, but they became even more dominant. So by the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia, 1787, by that time, they had become the most powerful advocates for the university, and a lot of the people who had initially wanted a public university were now skeptical of it because they were afraid that it was going to be a what they called a nursery of aristocracy, mm-hmm. because they thought the slave owners were going to control it. And it took, you know, just North Carolina rejected the U.S. Constitution to begin with because, you know, the counties like Orange and stuff in Mecklenburg, they were very revolutionary. They were very democratic. They didn't want any kind of aristocracy. And they objected to the Constitution for a variety of reasons. But especially because there was no Bill of Rights. So, let's see, we were talking about the trustees.
Right.
They were mostly big slave owners, and the students were mostly from slave-owning families, and many of them from gentry families. So the gifts to the university, the financial gifts that allowed it to build buildings and things, those were mostly from slave profits. The tuition that students paid was also from slave profits. Mm-hmm. The labor that constructed the university was was from slavery. And the other big source of income for the university, and it's a little bit of a surprise to people, the university was not funded by the legislature in terms of appropriations. They got an initial loan to build Old East of about, I think it was $10,000. And eventually that loan was turned by the legislature into a gift. But that was the only money that they got from the North Carolina legislature. Mm-hmm. And part of the reason for that, I think, was because there was a lot of people in the legislature who didn't trust the university. So there was opposition to funding the university. And of course, it was a poor state also. And this was going to be a university for the children of the wealthy. So what the state did do was they gave the university perpetual right to certain kinds of income. And these were of two kinds. The first kind, which was sort of short-lived and wasn't too much, was property that had been confiscated during the Revolution from Tories, from Loyalists, and back monies owed to the state by various people, and which had never been collected. So if the university would go out and collect these funds, then they could benefit from them. So that was one source of money. It wasn't, like I said, it wasn't an ongoing primary source of funding. The second source of funds was what was known as escheats. And an escheat is a legal term for property that goes from a private estate over to the state. And that happens in North Carolina whenever someone dies without a will or without legitimate heirs. Mm-hmm. So often people would die in North Carolina without wills. Because really only rich people had wills. And sometimes these people would be fairly well off, actually, and they would own slaves and all kinds of other property. Mm-hmm. And so what would happen is that when they would die, this land would be what's known as escheated to the state. And the university was allowed to go and collect this property, to claim it, and then sell it for cash that supplied income to the university.
No matter where that property was throughout the whole state.
Yeah, anywhere in the state.
On the coast or...
Didn't make any difference where it was. The university could take it and sell it.
So they would just go claim it and sell it.
Right. So actually, the university had a whole system of lawyers who were trustees and close friends of people at the university who were located in every county or every region, and it was their job to keep their eyes open for escheats, for when people died and stuff, and their job to go claim it. And then they would get a percentage of the take, and they would sell it and give the money to the university. And so it's actually through that process that we can very definitely say that the university owned and sold slaves, because often these estates included slaves.
And what time frame was that?
Well, this was from the founding of the university.
Uh-huh.
And actually, the whole thing about with the escheats, I don't think it stopped until about the 1970s or something. But, of course, there were only slaves involved up through 1865.
About 75 years.
Yeah. So, I have records, and the library has records on file, of estates that became university property because of this law, and we have some records of how much the slaves were sold for. And slaves were the most valuable kind of property in North Carolina. The land was much less valuable than slaves. So people's wealth, people invested in slaves in the same way people today would invest in stocks and bonds.
Right.
That was the way wealth was transferred and accumulated, was through slaves. Land as well, but land without slaves was of no value. So, for instance, one year, this woman named Dorothy Mitchell died, and she had four or five slaves, and they sold for somewhere between $2,000 and $3,000. And that turned out to be, somewhere between 5% and 10% of the university's entire budget that year.
This is like sold for each.
No, that was a total sales price. I think the university got something like $2,300 out of it, and the university budget that year was $36,000. And that $2,300 was about equal to the salary of the president of the university. So this was a very significant source of income.
At the beginning.
Yeah, it sort of petered out, but.
Yeah.
Particularly when slaves were involved, it was very important. And then the other big source of income was the sale of Western lands, because some of the original benefactors of the university, like Governor Smith, who Smith Hall is named for, people who were in the Revolutionary War as soldiers or officers were paid with land. This is the biggest scam in the world, because first of all, what the British did was they offered people land in exchange for settling it, and you could get an extra amount of land for every slave and every dependent you brought. So if you brought five slaves or five indentured servants or something, you would get more land the more you brought. And this land was not land that the British Crown owned. This was just land that they had laid claim to.
Right.
It belonged to Indians.
Right.
And so they would give this land away. And then during the Revolutionary War, the revolutionary government, you know, of the 13 colonies, didn't have hardly any money and often paid soldiers and officers with certificates of land. And if you were a general, you might get 20,000 acres of land. And if you were just a regular soldier, you might get 160 acres of land.
And where was this land?
This land mostly was in the western part of North Carolina. And see, Tennessee was part of North Carolina in those days.
Okay.
So it was in western North Carolina and Tennessee.
Okay.
Which again was not land that the revolutionary government owned. It was owned and occupied by various Indian tribes, the mm-hmm. Tuscaroras, the Cherokee, whoever. Mm-hmm. And General Smith had received 20,000 acres in Tennessee. And so he gave all of his land, his 20,000 acres, to the university as a gift. And, of course, this land was very difficult to turn into income because it was out there in the wilderness. You had to fight the Indians to get it. It hadn't been surveyed. You had to have a whole operation of speculators who would sell this land to individual settlers. And so it wasn't that big of a sacrifice to give away your western lands because for some people they would have thought it was more trouble than it was worth. But the university had the resources to turn this gifts like this into income. And they actually worked, the trustees worked with a bunch of land speculators to lobby the U.S. Congress to not allow Indians to claim this land. And so you basically had a coalition of university trustees and land speculators, they were often one and the same, who conspired to snatch away this Indian land and turn it into income for the university and for the other land speculators. That's the basis on which I say the university was founded on slavery and genocide.
So the genocide piece.
The genocide piece.
You don't hear too much about that.
You don't hear too much about that, but you talked to Joseph Jordan, at the Black Cultural Center. He's fairly insistent on things about Native Americans. But nobody knows this history. It's in my dissertation, but it's, no, you know, the popular idea is that there were no Indians in North Carolina.
So the university had their hands in two pots, but...
Yeah.
But they denied both, right?
Yeah.
No, that wasn't how we did it.
Right, and essentially all of this wealth was created by slavery. I mean, Benjamin Smith was a very big slave owner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's probably why he became a general in the first place.
Okay.
I don't know that much about his history. He died a pauper too, and a drunk. But but at one time he was very wealthy. This is the censored, unknown aspect of the university's connection with slavery and the dispossession of Indians.
Which I haven't heard of until just now.
Right. Well, mostly what I talk about is slavery.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's much harder to first of all, I don't know as much, but secondly, it's harder for people to grasp the thing about Indians because it's so far in the past and it's so outside their experience that, you know. But it's basic, it's fundamental. I mean, it's the whole basis of the development of the United States is based on land and labor.
Right.
And the initial land was Native American land, and the initial labor was slaves and indentured servants. So land and labor is what it comes down to.
So the university was given this land, and then they turned around and lobbied to have the Indians removed from the land. And then
not so much to have the Indians removed as to
occupy it.
Not recognize the Indians' legal claims with the U.S. government to the land.
Which happened, and then they turned around and sell the property to individuals. And that was a big source of their income.
Yeah, they probably worked with land speculators who would sell it to individuals. They set up a land office and stuff like that.
And this happened mostly in western North Carolina, or it happened all over the state?
No, western North Carolina and Tennessee.
Okay. Wow. So that's how the university got a lot of its startup monies.
Yes, its primitive accumulation of wealth came from slavery and Indian land.
In this 75-year period.
From about what? Yeah.
1795 to 1865.
70 years.
1865. Yeah, 70.
72 years, yeah. Whatever.
So then So now we've kind of moved to about 1865, right? And the university's up and going, and now the town of Chapel Hill is growing. Yeah, it's there. You want to make that a good stopping point, and we can.
It's up to you. I don't have anything else to do.
Yeah, let's stop for a second. Let me.
That's more of a. The outline of my thinking and an agenda for us talking. But I was trying to organize my thoughts, which I keep trying to do because, one, you know, I'm trying to write this thing called Fess Up, Silent Sam, Challenging Institutional Racism in the Southern Part of Heaven.
Uh-huh.
In which I want to pass on both the history and some of the struggles and organizing thoughts about, say, curriculum in public schools and public statues and all that. And it's a challenge to think how to present it, you know. And the other thing is that I want to try to train a core of people who know this stuff well enough to continue using it and developing this kind of work. So actually, what I'd like to do, or at least talk with you about, see if you think this is a good way to do it. What we're doing, to me, is the kind of thing that needs to happen in order for this dialogue to develop in such a way that you grab onto the knowledge and, you know, from a point of the view of a person who isn't an academic and doesn't have this knowledge, shape the discussion in such a way that it's meaningful.
Right.
Which is, you know, you're way more connected with the community than I am, and particularly with education. And so it doesn't do any good to present this stuff in ways that...
Right.
People don't care about or won't engage with.
Right. So let me ask you, Yanni, are you, in terms of the community, and you've been here a while, are you really the only person who, I'm sure you're not the only person who has this amount of knowledge, but are you really the person in this community who has just worked on it for years and years and years, and so you would have more
knowledge and information than anybody else?
Way more.
So I'm guessing some people have dabbled in it, but not really.
You know, there's another professor over at UNC who has studied the history of slavery at the university, and he leads Black History tours where they talk about these monuments and the building names and all that. He has a fair amount of knowledge. I don't think his knowledge is as broad, maybe even as deep as mine. But then again, I don't know exactly what he knows. I think he's going to write a book. Mm-hmm. But he also doesn't have the kind of involvement in the community that I have. Right. I mean, especially the whole thing of... I mean, he does these tours, which are very much applying this history to changing the world. But... he hasn't been involved in, you know, the struggle in education or police or housing or jobs. And the kind of knowledge that I don't have is the kind of knowledge that people who grew up here and lived through things and have stories passed down from their families have. I've absorbed some of that, but the richness of those kinds of details and experiences and the feelings involved, I have less of that. But I often know more about the actual development of the community than someone like Fred Battle, just because I've studied the newspapers, I've studied the documents, I've read the stuff that's been written on the development of the community center. And so I know a lot of people, you know, give me some credit for bringing this knowledge back to the community. Not like nobody knew anything, but of course, nobody knows, nobody in the community knows anything about this history of the university.
Now, does Fred Battle and some of those guys, those families, do they know?
Well, they have some personal experience with it, and they have absorbed a good deal of knowledge about it over the years because it's been part of the work that we've all done together. And some of them have done some looking into these things on their own. There was a guy who died named Ed Caldwell Jr., who was descended from that November Caldwell, the first slave. Okay. And he had done quite a bit of research, and he wanted to write a book. But the fact is that nearly all the Black people in Chapel Hill who want to write books or who want to put their thoughts down aren't able to do it because of the pressures of living. And I've been privileged in the sense of, you know, I haven't had to deal with those things as much as they have. I've had more time, I've had more resources. I'm a privileged white guy, and the only good thing about that is if you turn that to use that privilege to build a movement against privilege and, you know, fight for racial justice and all that. But I've had the educational background, I've had the resources, I've had the time, you know, to do that. And so really, other people are, some of the people in Hidden Voices, for instance, some of the people in UNC now are starting to develop some of this knowledge. Hidden Voices folks have a lot of knowledge about the Jim Crow Black community.
Yeah, their knowledge comes from where you get your knowledge as well, or does their knowledge come from stories?
Their knowledge comes from two places. One is a lot of it comes from me, mm-hmm. from the things I've written and from the conversations I've had with them. And two, they've gone out into the community and interviewed people and talked with people and, you know, have... began doing their own direct, have their direct experience. And to me, that's the basic theoretical framework for how you got to build a movement, is there have to be some people with intellectual qualifications and experience and research and all that kind of stuff. But that's only indirect knowledge. You know, you pick it up from all these sources. And then there's direct knowledge, which is, you know, actually living it or talking with people or experiencing things. And those two things have to be blended.
And that's what Hidden Voices is doing.
Hidden Voices is doing some of that, yes. They're doing really good stuff.
And their production, right? They do plays and...
Yeah, they did We're Still Here and Moving, mm-hmm. which is a collage of acting and voices mm-hmm. directly from people in Northside about their experiences growing up during Jim Crow. And that kind of stuff has only been developing in the last five or...
Couple of years.
But there's a lot more of it than there used to be before we had these campaigns. You have enough time to talk a little bit about the statues and get started there?
Yeah.
Well, you know, if you look at, you've got this period of slavery where the university was run by slave owners. When emancipation came along, these same slave owners who were the leaders of the university and the most powerful people in North Carolina, they tried to write new laws called the Black Codes that would virtually put black people back into slavery, but outside the framework of legal slavery. So they would be working on plantations and doing this, that, and the other, and having hardly any rights at all.
These were the trustees?
Some of the main people who wrote the slave codes were trustees of the university or faculty at the university.
And they wrote these after the emancipation?
Yes. They did this during the couple of years which were known as presidential reconstruction from 1865 to 1867. And then what happened was the radical Republicans in Congress impeached the president and overthrew this presidential reconstruction plan. And they abolished the black codes. They disfranchised a lot of the old Confederate leaders. Mm-hmm. And they voted the franchise to African Americans. This created this whole new situation in the South. And for a few years in North Carolina, and longer in some places like South Carolina, a coalition of freed slaves and former free black people combined with maybe 20% of the white population that was non-slave owners for the most part, and a tiny percentage of the gentry who had sort of came over to this side. And plus what they called the, it's a very misleading term, the carpetbaggers, who are seen usually as white people coming into the South. And some of them were very skillful and became involved in this radical Reconstruction politics. The thing that's often left out there is that there was a whole lot of black people who had been slaves or who were living in other parts of the free United States, and they came to the South. A lot of them came with the Union Army, actually, and they ended up staying here because they wanted to, you know, develop emancipation for their people, and they started schools and did all kinds of things.
This was after 1867.
This was after 1867, yeah. And so for a brief time, the university was run by these radical Republicans. And the old gentry had no hand in it. But the old gentry eventually organized these white supremacy campaigns, the Ku Klux Klan and all this stuff, and they basically overthrew radical Reconstruction, again, control of the legislature in 1870 and the governorship in 1876. And they regained control of the university in 1874, when they kicked out the Radical Republican Board of Trustees and appointed all these old white supremacists, Paul Cameron and William L. Saunders, the head of the Klan, and a whole variety of people. So from then on, the university was sort of the headquarters of white supremacy in North Carolina.
So I'm thinking about Cameron Boulevard.
Yes. Cameron Avenue.
Cameron Avenue. Whose idea was... Whose idea was that, and how long ago was that?
I always get a little confused on this. But it was probably Paul Cameron's idea.
And he was, again, going back, his family owned the largest number of slaves in Orange County.
Yeah,
back
this, in the this probably happened in the later 19th century, I'm thinking. It was originally called College Avenue. And then I think what happened after 1875, when the university reopened under the control of these white supremacists, go on. Paul Cameron donated a lot of money. He was the president of the Board of Trustees Executive Committee, and I think one of the things they did was they made Cameron what had been College Avenue. They turned that into Cameron Avenue. That may have happened later. I'm not totally sure. Mm-hmm. But it's all part of the same kind of thing about commemoration of the white supremacists that the Confederate statue is about also, although that came a little bit later. So all these early buildings were named after slave owners. Up through the 1970s, all the new buildings were named after white supremacists, virtually.
So where we are in 2009, has any group or anyone challenged changing some of this?
Yeah. And that's a lot of what our movement has been about, that I've been working on, and that Black students worked on before me, and that the Black housekeepers, for instance, part of the housekeepers' lawsuit, which was settled for about $1 million worth of settlement, you know, in terms of wages and so on and so forth. That happened in 1996, and part of their lawsuit was actually a reparations lawsuit. And so it included all this history. And I was their expert witness. Al McShirley was their lawyer. And so we were going to go to court, and we were going to expose this whole history. Mm-hmm. And after the attorney general of the state, a guy named Zyko, we call him Psycho Zyko, he called me in to debrief me, you know, take my, what do you call that? Discovery. That was part of discovery.
Right.
Discovery. And so I went in there and sat with him for a couple of hours, and he challenged me with questions about what did I know. And after that, the university came to the table and, you know, made a settlement, because I think they realized, in part, that the housekeepers movement was very strong with a lot of support on campus, and in part that the expert witness for the housekeepers really knew a lot. And
so you weren't able to have your day in court.
We were not able to have our day in court, which is really sad. But we built on that, and part of the settlement was for there to be a commission to honor Black UNC workers. Mm-hmm. And what they did was they eventually renamed the laundry building out on Cameron Avenue for Rebecca Clark and Kenan Cheek, who were leaders of the union and the housekeepers and so on and so forth back in the 1940s.
Is that where we get Kenan Stadium?
No. That's William Rand Kenan's family. Okay. William Rand Kenan was a UNC student who helped discover carbide, the formula for how to produce carbide, and was a founder of Union Carbide Corporation. Hmm. And was also one of the leaders of the white supremacist coup in Wilmington in 1898. He rode around behind the machine gun. And anyways, you know, so they got this long history, and they basically commemorated white supremacy up through the years. And in 1907, the Daughters of the Confederacy, Mercy on the Daughters of the Confederacy, proposed that the university erect a monument to the university people who had either died or been active in the Civil War, to the Confederates, Confederate veterans.
There was had nothing to do with the university.
What didn't?
The Confederate soldiers.
Well, the university supplied a very large number of Confederate soldiers. They all left the university and they joined the Confederate Army.
They were students.
Yeah, they were students. And a lot of them died, and a lot of them became officers, and they were mostly from slave-owning families, and they were from all across the South, because by that time, the university had become the best and biggest public university in the South. Mm-hmm. So the university had spread the influence of slavery all through Georgia and all those places. But they sent their kids back to UNC to get educated. So they didn't have diddly squat in terms of education in Alabama and Georgia.
Okay.
So the university joined the university alumni, mm-hmm. led by President Venable, whose father owned Stone Mountain in Georgia, where the Klan had its big revival in the 1915. President Venable threw his entire weight behind this project and worked with the Daughters of the Confederacy, or whatever, Daughters of the mm-hmm. Confederate Veterans, I guess. And they raised money for this statue. And there were statues like this going up all over the South, you know, particularly towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. And part of the reason was because the Confederate veterans were dying out. And there was this whole nostalgic movement called the Lost Cause, which was a celebration of the Confederacy and claiming that the Civil War had nothing to do with slavery and, you know, all this stuff you'll still hear from neo-Confederates today. So this was part of a much larger movement. There have been quite a few books written about this, including by a UNC professor named Fitz Brundage. And the daughters proposed to raise this money through their various chapters in North Carolina with the help of the alumni. But as it turned out, the daughters were able to only raise part of what they said they could raise. They might have raised $1,200 or $2,000, but the total cost of the thing was $7,500. And that was raised by a very intensive letter-writing campaign and work by the president of the university, President Venable, which I researched. I spent like a month or two researching this and going mm-hmm. through all of the letters. And he must have sent out, at some periods of time, he was sending out 5 letters a day to people asking them for anywhere from $5 to $500.
Right.
And they organized this whole reunion in 1911. And they promised all these people who came and who gave money that they would be written up in a book in Memorial Hall and honored, and that they would all get degrees from the university if they had attended the university, but they hadn't been able to get their degree because of the Civil War. So they were all given degrees and stuff like that. It was in my opinion, it was mostly about raising money for the statue. But in any case, they raised the money for the statue, and finally in 1913, they erected the statue. And
the university mostly.
Yes, they say that the daughters did it, but it was actually, I mean, the plaque on the side says the daughters and the university alumni, but frankly, it was the president of the university mm-hmm. who put the time into it, and it was some of the prominent alumni and trustees mm-hmm. who put the money into it, like Julian Shakespeare Carr. Carr Building is named for him. He was a white supremacist candidate in the early, 1900s.
Carr Court?
Probably, yeah. Yeah. C-A-R-R, Carrborough. He owned Carrborough.
He'd turn over in his grave if he knew that building was used for Head Start, huh?
he could. So they put up this statue, and it's a little bit different from other Confederate statues because it is for people from all the Confederate states because all of them went to the university. So it's not North Carolina veterans or mm-hmm. anything like that. And also because those who went into the Confederacy from the university were mostly from slave-owning families, whereas most Confederate soldiers were poor white people, independent farmers, and they weren't necessarily fighting to protect slavery. In fact, later on, when they thought it was a slave owner's war, they deserted in vast numbers. Mm-hmm. But so they're mostly slave owners, and they were from all over the South. And so this is on the university property, and it is meant to be the main portal to the university and the primary statue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, the location.
Clearly,
yeah,
right? It's very big and statuesque.
Yeah, and so that was done in 1913.
That was done in 1913. And you have to remember that the white supremacy campaign of 1898 overthrew the populists and the fusionists, who were this biracial coalition who had kicked the mm-hmm. the democratic white supremacists out of power. And in 1898, they overthrew that coalition with the particular use of the Wilmington mm-hmm. coup and riot and all that. And then in 1900, they started passing, they passed the law to disfranchise black voters. And so that was the beginning, and they also passed at the same time, I think 1899 was the first Jim Crow law in North Carolina. Mm-hmm. It was about railroads or public transportation or something. And so this was the beginning of Jim Crow, and white supremacy was at a fever pitch in the early part of the 19th century. And so all of these buildings, like, you had Silent Sam, the Confederate statue. Have you heard that name?
I have.
Yes, it's called Silent Sam. That's a more complex story. It wasn't called Silent Sam to begin with. It was called the Soldiers' Monument.
Okay.
But in any case, that was put up in 1913. And then you had a series of buildings named after famous Confederates, like mm-hmm. Battle, Vance, Pettigrew. That's all slavery, Confederate people. And then you had this whole slew of new buildings that were named after slave owners or white supremacists, and that was Saunders Hall, which was named after the head of the Klan, and Murphy Hall, which was named after a big slave owner earlier in the 19th century, and Manning Hall, which was named after the guy who started the law school, and he was also a white supremacist. So that little quad, I call it Klan Quad. although the only one who was in the Klan was Saunders, but that by itself would make it enough. So all these buildings were put up, and they all commemorated white supremacy, and they sort of tried to enshrine that in brick and bronze and granite and make that an everlasting principle of the university. Of course, at the same time, The NAACP was starting in North Carolina in the 1913-1914. Mm-hmm. There was all kinds of protests against Jim Crow. And so, you know, this was an attempt to consolidate cultural hegemony on the issue of white supremacy. And really from that point on, from the 20s on, that started getting challenged and undermined at UNC in a variety of ways, even though UNC remained a Jim Crow institution formally up until the 1960s.
The NAACP was here in 1916?
Not in Chapel Hill. It was in Raleigh. It was in Durham.
Okay.
I'm not quite sure. There was an NAACP here in the 1940s and 50s, I think.
So was it those people from Raleigh and Durham that came and started challenging?
No. It was very indirect. Black people in Chapel Hill challenged Jim Crow in a variety of ways, mostly by strengthening their own communities and culture and promoting education and public health and, you know, employment opportunities and things like that. But at the university, what happened was that the university started hiring people who thought that it was important to understand the Negro, so to speak, because that was such a big part of life in the South that if you didn't understand the problem of the Negro, it was going to have bad effects on the white community. Mm-hmm. And so Howard Odom was hired to set up the sociology department, and he sort of nurtured a whole cadre of graduate students who went out and studied the Negro and the Negro problem in the South. And he was relatively conservative to begin with. He got a little bit better later on. Mm-hmm. But some of his students were fairly progressive, and they were sort of like Frank Porter Graham liberals, you know, so almost social democrats, some of them. And they did a lot of groundbreaking research on things like lynching and social conditions and stuff locally in Chapel Hill that anybody but me and a few other people know about. They wrote theses and papers on this. And this fed into a movement for what was called interracialism, which was not directly challenging Jim Crow, but which was saying, let's moderate Jim Crow. Let's have better relationships with Negro people. Often people were saying this because it's for our own good. It's for white people's benefit. Mm-hmm. And
what time frame was that, Yanni?
This was in the 1920s and the 1930s, mm-hmm. and interracialism in Chapel Hill in particular developed in the 1940s. And I think a lot of it was stimulated by the CIO union that came here in 1942. That I can tell you about some other time. Nobody knows about that either, although we're starting to get the word out. But there were ministers like Reverend Charlie Jones, who we commemorated at the Freedom Riders thing. And he was a very strong opponent of Jim Crow. Mm-hmm. And he wasn't exactly saying, let's overthrow Jim Crow, mm-hmm. but he would do things concretely that really crossed the color line and challenged Jim Crow. So you had this kind of movement that developed among white academics and students and community workers and liberal church people and communists and socialists. And all of this was little by little undermining Jim Crow.
So the university was a part of that?
The people at the university were a part of that.
Is that a small portion?
That was a small portion of the university. That the university has built its reputation on those people because it likes to present itself as a liberal institution.
Right.
But in reality, the trustees were incredibly racist, and they really curtailed what these folks were able to do. They had to constantly look over their shoulders at the trustees, and Frank Porter Graham was prohibited from doing a lot of things that he wanted to do that would have promoted interracialism, like he wanted the union to be able to negotiate for a contract, and trustees said no way.
So these trustees, this history of these trustees were in place for how long? They're still there in the 40s?
The trustees are still there today. Each university has a board of trustees, and in 1930s the university system was founded, and so there is a board of trustees of the university system, and then there's a board of trustees of each institution.
So these particular people that we're talking about, the white supremacists, the ones that were around in the early 1900s, they were still around in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s?
Them were their ideological descendants.
Okay.
Yeah. Even when the university was forced to integrate in the 1950s, the guy who was president of the Board of Trustees said, well, we're going to have to give in to this because the Supreme Court has ruled that you have to have equal graduate schools for everybody, and like there's no medical school for black people and so on and so forth. So they admitted a medical student, and then they admitted four law students after a lawsuit. But he said, I am completely opposed to desegregating of the undergraduates. And, you know, he was very much outspoken about that. He's in my dissertation prime, you know, featured his quotes. And so really UNC got dragged kicking and screaming into the era of desegregation. They don't claim that. They claim that they were sort of a pathbreaker, the first university to voluntarily admit a black graduate student, which is true. But they really had no choice. They would have been sued and been forced to admit that graduate student. And so they put up this monument to the Confederate soldier, and that has remained the most prominent monument on campus to this day.
Right.
And then in
almost 100 years.
Yeah. And then in maybe, I forget when it started, but actually a movement started among the students, although I'm not quite sure how that came about.
Mm-hmm.
But the presidents of the senior class one year decided that the class gift would be a monument to the black workers who built the university.
And that was in 2002.
Well, that's when it got
erected.
I think that decision was made in 2000 or maybe before
Okay.
And actually one of those students was black, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And this sort of came after a lot of the agitation that had already gone on. So I'm sure it was inspired in part by what we'd been doing. And I met the guy up in the Southern Historical Collection when he was doing research, and we discussed it and all that. But the initial impulse from the students, I think, was very positive. But somewhere along the line, because of the institutional racism of the university itself and the professional groupings, this idea got shaped in such a way that it was no challenge to Silent Sam. That it was very passive, didn't even talk about slaves, talking about people bond and free.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who knows what bond means? Some people do, but didn't even use the word slaves. And they decided on this architect who was not from the South, was not black. They rejected Juan Logan's proposal, for instance. He's like a big person in the art department at UNC. An African-American, and he got the contract for the Freedom monument in Raleigh. So he's, mm-hmm. you know, very professionally qualified. They rejected him.
No, when you say they, who's they?
There was a, once this idea got passed, and they went through quite a struggle to get it on McCorkle Place because the trustees didn't really want it, you know, around Silent Sam or anything at all like that. So so the students really felt that it needed to be, you know, on that most hallowed ground. And so that was somewhat of a struggle. But once they got that approved, then they had an artistic selection committee. Mm-hmm. And the artistic selection committee was all white. It's like 14 or 15 white professionals. Now, that's partly institutional racism because, first of all, that they even set it up being all white. But part of the reason it was all white was because they, you know, didn't have too many black professionals. I mean, it was a segregated... I'm sure there were, and they could have gotten them, mm-hmm. but they didn't go out of their way mm-hmm. to find African Americans to serve on that committee. And they only picked professional people as opposed to, they never consulted with folks in the black community in Chapel Hill or with the black student movement. Right. It was just such an obvious, incredible, racially insensitive way to go about doing things that had a virtually predictable, racially insensitive, horrible outcome,
right.
Even though there was a good impulse that started it. And Juan Logan would have been on that selection committee, except that he had submitted a proposal. So he said, no, I can't be on the selection yeah. committee. Yeah. So, you know, he was like their one black person. And so then this thing got set up, and there was this idea that everybody thought was wonderful, which was that art, public art, should no longer be monumental. It should be more inviting and engaging. So a table with benches or little stools. The stools, by the way, are modeled on black slave fieldstone grave markers, you know, with the top cut off. And, you know, it was done by this person who was totally out of touch with the black community. He's Korean from New York or someplace. And had no concept of any, no connection at all with the black community here in Chapel Hill. And as far as I know, didn't do any consulting. And so this thing was brought out. And frankly, a lot of black people in Chapel Hill were sort of happy about it initially. And the reason for that is, I think, pretty sad, which was that it's like, well, usually we get nothing. This is something.
So up to that point, up to 2002, where there's this little table on the campus, is that the first commemoration?
That's not the first commemoration. You know, like I said, in 96 or 97, there was this laundry building.
Okay, you're right.
Right? And even before that, admissions building was renamed for the first two black professors. And then there's now a total of about five buildings named for African Americans, which is more than virtually any other university in the country.
Since 2002?
Well, I'd say this process started in the 90s, maybe.
Okay.
I'm not sure when the building was named for the African American. The School of Public Health building has one African American in the three names because he was head of the School of Public Health. And they recently renamed one of the buildings that had been newly built that didn't really have a permanent name. They renamed that for George Moses Horton, who is the black slave poet. Mm-hmm. We haven't talked much about resistance to slavery, but George Moses Horton was part of that resistance, and there's a lot of other things we could talk about in terms of that. But that's sort of the there's been a lot more commemoration since we started a movement to tear down Silent Sam.
How's that movement going?
No, it got cut off with death threats and various other things.
Really?
It wasn't very it wasn't very well organized. It was the director of the Black Cultural Center wrote a newspaper piece about it. And, you know, I sort of came in belatedly and supported him, but by and large it was denounced far and wide. And he got a lot of death threats and white supremacy stuff. And
in the last 10 years?
Yeah. I think he came out with his first article in maybe 1999 or something.
Wow.
I ran into him day before yesterday, Gerald Horn. And when I did the Cornelia Spencer Love campaign, I got death threats, and I was on white supremacy websites. I mean, if you do anything about any kind of white supremacist stuff and challenging it, and they'll immediately blow it up into a big issue for you. It's quite a good way to get publicity.
So is the white supremacy movement still pretty big here?
Well, this is not necessarily a local white supremacy movement. This is more of a national white supremacy movement. Like the National Rights of White People, David Duke. There's a whole variety of these militia, neo-Confederate, and Nazi and right-wing organizations.
You said David Duke?
Yeah. He started the, I think it's called the Rights of White People. They have this gigantic blog.
Okay. It has nothing to do with
Duke University? Yes. No.
Okay.
Uh-uh. He is a Klansman from Louisiana. Nowadays, black people in Chapel Hill don't like this monument because, you know, the Unsung Founders Monument, which is a bad name to begin with.
Monument for the people who built the university.
Yeah, they were forced to build it and forced to do this work. It wasn't.
It was free.
Wasn't like they were founders,
right.
Except in the sense that they didn't contribute their labor. Yeah, you go.
Go.
Go, doggies. Shoo, shoo.
Trying to do that Caesar. What's his name? Doesn't work.
Hey, doggies. Shoo, shoo. Go, go, go. Go hang your heads and lie down over there.
So when you say that the black people in the community don't like this statue now, are these newer members to the community, or are these people who have been here but just maybe have a little more knowledge base in history now, and so now there's
people have thought it over, mm-hmm. and I think people have decided that you know, this crumb that we got, that the black community got,
right.
is really as much of an insult as it is an honor.
Right.
A number of people at the university have been furious about it. For instance, Reg Hildebrand, who's a black professor in the FM department. And he and I and some other people were on a whole panel about the Unsung Founders Monument and basically what was wrong with it. But nobody's actually tried to do anything yet concrete mm-hmm. about it.
Mm-hmm. So I think they're sitting there. And
it's sort of sitting there, and Silent Sam is sitting there. And I think there are definite things that we could do, but we need a coalescence of people who feel that way and are willing to do something. And so there's
death threats.
You know, the death threats aren't as big of a deal here in Chapel Hill as they were, yeah. say, for Al Brophy and University of Alabama when he got the faculty to apologize for slavery. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're real, and there's some that's local,
right.
but, you know, we do have a fairly broad liberal support here. But white liberals are not very aware of institutional racism. And so to me, trying to challenge things on this cultural front of history and commemoration, it sort of makes light bulbs go off in people's minds, mm-hmm. and it helps them realize that they have had blinders on, and if they couldn't see the fact that the entire commemorative landscape was white,
right.
if they hadn't noticed that, maybe they haven't noticed why there's such a huge gap in the public schools, or what's going on with police in the black community, or
right.
employment, or
right.
these other things. So to me, it's and then you can explain what the problems are today by just tracing them, their development in history. So I think that's where the commemoration provides sort of a focus of attention, and it's something that can be done without. Unless you're trying to move Silent Sam, you're not totally trying to subvert the most cherished aspects of white supremacy, the institutional exploitation, for instance. Mm-hmm. So you can do that kind of thing and get fairly broad public support, and within that framework, you can bring in all the history and get people to start to understand this stuff, and then, although I don't think we figured out how to do this yet, what we have to do, I think, is figure out how to concretely link this struggle on the cultural front with the other areas of struggle, the transformation of the schools, the transformation of institutional racism in employment and housing and police relations and things like that, so that this history and commemoration can become a real tool for organizing.
Right.
And that's sort of the challenge that I'm seeing right now. Well, we've gotten to the place where we started to know how to do it, mm-hmm. but how to link it and get it more broadly part of the movement, I think, is where I'm particularly struck by the fact that if I die sometime soon, it'll be harder for people to do that. I think people will do it anyways. I think some of the resources are out there now for mm-hmm. people to do it. But I think it'll be harder, and so to me it's very important to train some people to be able to do that work. And what I never proposed to you, but I will now, is that we have sort of a small study group of people. And I know that who's our friend who Nancy McDermott.
Yes.
Nancy McDermott has offered to host something like that at her house.
Right.
Although I don't necessarily think we should only do it at her house.
Yes.
But if we had a small group, we could have the kind of conversations that you and I are having now. Mm-hmm. But you could help me figure out actually how to do it so it wouldn't drag out for 2 hours,
right.
And how to develop materials out of that, and organizing plans, and
right.
so on and so forth. So,
no, I think Nancy came to me about a month ago when I saw her last, and we were talking, and she was asking me about, you know, how do we pull this together and get some of Yanni's, you know, do some oral history and just get some of this stuff, you know. Because I think she was feeling like me, you know, we need to get as much as we can, you know, and keep this thing going and moving and getting it out there. And so I know she's very much on board, and, you know, I'll have that conversation with her again. Hey, we're the ball's rolling now. I mean, it's, you know, so.
I think we should try to do that really soon. There's no telling how long I'm going to feel healthy. And I think one of the things that the way I've been increasingly focusing on it is trying to think who in particular will be an advocate for these things mm-hmm. and will take this study thing that we do
right.
and actually carry it forward. So there's lots of people who would be interested in a study group or a, whatever we call it. But we need at least a core of people in there who will really be activists for the rest of their lives on this kind of thing.
And just with the colleagues and the group of people that you know now, do you have a good base of, I mean, at least a good start, maybe a few people?
Well, I have to talk it over with folks. I mean, I've thought about it a lot. Mm-hmm. And I'd say among the white people I know, Nancy is by far at the top of the list.
Yeah.
But there are other people, potentially. Mm-hmm. And among black people, there's a lot more. Mm-hmm. Although most of the black people I work with are involved in, you know, kinds of struggle that aren't necessarily that much about history and commemoration. But if we were able to make this part of the larger struggle,
right.
I think there would be people. I think someone like Barbara Hopkins would be very interested in a big addition to a group like that.
Mm-hmm.
She has both the direct experience and the interest.
And she's from here?
She's from here. She's James Britton's sister.
Okay.
And there's a variety of other people, too. But, I mean, we'd have to sit down and talk through names. And you know, someone like Nate would be great.
Right.
But it's not clear that Nate would have the time to do this kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
He's always wanted me to do a program like this at Hargraves, mm-hmm. you know, for the community, which is something I'd love to do, but I have not had the energy
right.
to do it. But it might be that a sort of train the trainers approach
right.
Could result in people who could lead this work among other groups of people.
Right.
You know, so I don't necessarily have, I'll think about it some more, but I don't necessarily have a definite core. I think Dawn would be great.
I do too.
You know,
Dawn and Nancy, and maybe we can get them, you know, let me talk to them. I forget when we can do this and start having this dialogue that you talk about. Have you ever been able to take your collective work and do a lecture series?
No.
I have done
lectures.
I mean, just what we've gone over, we started in, you know, 1620 and moved it through the 1700s and then, you know, 1800s.
I have not been disciplined or skillful enough to actually come up with, you know, bite-sized lectures or presentations.
But that could be something that actually stems from...
Absolutely. That's what I'm thinking, you know.
About, you know, a lecture series at the Friday Center, you know, with just the history from the beginning of the university, or even pre-university to where we are now. And I mean, you could, you know, that would be a nice little series for people to get some of this history that we don't talk about.
Right. Well, you know, you've got a bunch of it here in terms of slavery with a little bit built up on, mm-hmm. on that even up to the present. And you could think about that and we could talk about it in this little core group.
Yeah.
And think about what kind of a presentation or lecture or slideshow or whatever
mm-hmm.
would be effective for different audiences, like a school audience,
right.
a Friday Center audience, a Hargrave audience, something that could be adapted by Hidden Voices.
Right. So we might want to have one of them at the table.
If we could get Kathy or Lyndon, or maybe somebody they know,
mm-hmm.
at the table, that would be great.
Jennifer Evans, do you know her?
Her name sounds familiar. Who is she?
She's part of Hidden Voices, and she sings.
Oh, I do know Jennifer Evans. I do, and she's got kids in the school.
Yes.
She's a gospel singer.
Yes.
In fact, I have her album.
She's wonderful.
And I've talked with her. Yes, she'd be great.
She's a good one. And
but I don't know what her... I think she would be great no matter what, but I don't know what her actual commitment to organizing is.
I know she's got a commitment to what some of the things that Kev and I are doing, where she started this parent group at McDougal Elementary, and now that she's moving on to middle school, she was concerned that it was going to fall off, but her issues too are, you know, it's the achievement gap and why are we where we are and still frustrated and still having these issues, especially in this community where the resources are vast and there's no excuse. So
institutional racism and then again the legacy of slavery. It's hard for me to talk about this, to put it into words. It's almost more of a feeling that I have, but this whole history bears down on black people in a way that other people, even other people of color, Latino people, for instance, cannot comprehend. And black people themselves, I think, generally don't want to acknowledge it or don't necessarily see it. Some do, some don't. I mean... there's been people, activist academics in particular, who've written about it, calling slavery soul murder. And, you know, the guy, Randall Robinson, who wrote the book The Debt. Mm-hmm. You know that?
Mm-hmm.
You should look at that. The Debt. And it's a great book. I've got it someplace.
I was gonna say, I think I saw it on the bookshelf.
Could be. One of my sort of fundamental texts. And he was the head of TransAfrica and the leader of the anti-apartheid movement in the U.S. And this book is about reparations. And it is very much about what the legacy of slavery has done to black people and how people have internalized it and how that can be challenged and fought.
Mm-hmm.
What impact it has for instance on people thinking there must be something wrong with me, or you know, that whole idea that black people are to blame,
mm-hmm.
stupid, lazy, whatever.
Right, right.
All of this comes out of that legacy of slavery.
Right.
And if you don't know the history as a black person, then you are lost.
Right.
I mean, black people are the only people in the United States who don't have a history. I mean, you have a history. Black people have a history in this country. But there's a big break at slavery because people often can't get past slavery to know anything about their families.
Mm-hmm.
And their families were disrupted. And there's a big break when people came from Africa, because all of that cultural knowledge and language and history and family, clan, whatever structures, totally got removed by force.
Right.
And so, you know, a lot of people have histories that go back hundreds or thousands of years. Black people usually don't. It goes back a few hundred.
Right.
So what does that mean for a person, that you have no history, or that you don't have that kind of long history?
Right, or that you're told that your history starts here.
Yeah, that your history starts here when you were a slave.
Right.
And, you know, so, you know, and that's part of something that I think should be addressed in the public schools.
I want to ask you something, not...